Wednesday, December 4, 2013. I'm Albert Moeller, and this is The Briefing, a daily analysis of news and events from a Christian worldview. From time to time, we realize that much of the action taking place in this culture takes place in the courts. And now the scene shifts to the New York State Supreme Court, which is soon to take up a case asking the basic question, are chimpanzees legal persons? If that sounds like an esoteric argument, you need to pay closer attention. Because this is the culmination of many different cases, it represents a movement among animal rights activists and others to try to have human beings and animals classified as legally indistinct, especially when it comes to those animals defined as more intelligent, the higher primates. CNN reports the question is, should a captive chimpanzee have the same rights as a legal person? That's the debate, they say, set to unfold after an activist group filed lawsuits on behalf of four chimpanzees asking the New York Supreme Court to grant them, quote, the right to bodily liberty. Stephen M. Wise is the founder and president of a group known as the Non-Human Rights Project. He said, quote, when we go to court on behalf of the first chimpanzee plaintiffs, we'll be asking judges to recognize for the first time that these cognitively complex, autonomous beings have the basic legal right not to be imprisoned, end quote. Now, what we're looking at here is, as you might expect, a basic clash of worldviews. The worldview on one side says that human beings are distinct from every other creature, distinct not only in terms of capacity and function, but distinct in terms of status, the status being that every single human being is made in God's image. That is a theologically informed, indeed a biblically informed worldview. It is also a worldview that, by common grace, have been understood by most human beings throughout most of human history. Until lately, another worldview has been gaining traction. That worldview is contrary to the biblical worldview that says that the status of human beings is categorically different from the rest of creation. Instead, this worldview argues that human beings are on a continuum of intelligence and consciousness that affects the animal kingdom, such that the animal kingdom should be recognized as having a gradient and increasing on the one hand or decreasing on the other hand level of intelligence and consciousness, autonomy and personhood that should be increasingly legally affirmed. Now, this is not just a matter of abstract legal theory. This is a case to go before the New York State Supreme Court. What's at stake here, however, is not just the future of four captive chimpanzees, but the larger question of human dignity and, of course, the relationship between human beings and other animals, including primates. CNN reports that the four chimpanzees involved in this legal action are Tommy, he's 26, living in a trailer lot in Gloversville, New York, Kiko, 26, who formerly worked in the entertainment industry, now living presumably in retirement in Niagara Falls, and then Hercules and Leo, identified as two young male chimpanzees owned by the New Iberia Research Center, used in a locomotion research experiment in the anatomy department at Stony Brook University in Stony Brook, New York. Here are the four plaintiffs, except they're not actually plaintiffs, because at this point at least, chimpanzees do not have legal standing as legal persons in any court in the United States. But what Stephen Wise and his associates are actually trying to do here is to create a legal context in which personhood, legally speaking, would be granted to these four chimpanzees. And of course, that wouldn't just relate to these four primates, but rather to the entire animal kingdom, if the logic is accepted. But you really see where Stephen Wise and his associates are going when you listen to their language. He said this, for instance, quote, not long ago, people generally agreed that human slaves could not be legal persons, but were simply the property of their owners. We will assert, based on clear scientific evidence, that it's time to take the next step and recognize that these non-human animals cannot continue to be exploited as the property of their human owners. Owners put in quotation marks. Now let's look at that statement for a moment. Here you have a man trying to make a very straightforward comparison between human beings and these chimps, arguing that these chimps should be understood as slaves, as being imprisoned, not merely held in captivity. A similar kind of statement with worldview importance was made by Joyce Tischler, identified as the co-founder of a group, the Animal Legal Defense Fund. Tischler said, quote, to be a legal person, one doesn't need to be a human being or even a biological being. She actually went on, however, to compare these chimps to children in terms of the effort to gain legal standing and legal representation before the New York court. She said, quote, we see that in children. They can be removed from an abusive home and be protected even though the child might not be able to formulate those desires and the issues represented in the court of law, end quote. So here you have yet another effort to try to draw a human comparison, to suggest that these chimps are basically to be understood as legally equivalent to human beings. What is the suit aiming for? Well, as the Non-Human Rights Project says in its statement, the lawsuits are seeking for the four chimpanzees to be moved to a sanctuary, quote, where they can live out their days with others of their kind in an environment as close to the wild as is possible in North America, end quote. But what's actually at stake in this legal action isn't just the fate of these four chimpanzees, but rather the fate of our understanding of the relationship between human beings and the animal kingdom. We need to recognize just how dangerous this kind of development is, because there has been a movement building for some time, about since the midpoint of the 20th century, to push the animal rights agenda to this kind of legal extremity. What we're looking at here is the setup for something that won't affect merely four chimps in New York State, but the larger legal landscape in the United States. And we need to recognize that the ground has been shifting, legally speaking, on this question in other nations already. For instance, Spain, just a few years ago, did legally recognize chimps as having legal standing, just like human beings in court. A Christian perspective on this issue does remind us of our responsibility to the animal kingdom. We are given the command of dominion in the book of Genesis, but we are also given the responsibility of stewardship. Cruelty towards any animal, chimpanzees or otherwise, is inexcusable from a Christian perspective. But it's also inexcusable to confuse that bright, very clear biblical line between the human being and the animal kingdom. What we're looking at here is not just a continuum. By the way, in most cases, that kind of legal or worldview argument about a continuum of worth turns out to be deadly dangerous. The Nazis followed a similar kind of continuum argument amongst human beings, arguing that there was a gradient degree of human dignity even among human beings. That was a great travesty that led to an unspeakable tragedy. And that should be something that should inform us even in this. To try to put human beings now in this kind of gradient with other animals won't just raise the animals, it will lower human dignity. And that will endanger every single human being. Of course, there are some almost hilarious incongruities here. These chimpanzees are not representing themselves in court. They're not asking for this case. Human beings are having to ask on their behalf. Human beings are doing so in order to start a human legal process they hope will come to a human legal conclusion. In other words, these chimpanzees are not human beings. That's acknowledged even by the plaintiffs in this case. And they should not have legal standing, even though this court in New York may try to recognize such. What we're looking at here is a confusion that can have deadly effect, but also is very revealing when it comes to the depth of the worldview conflict in terms of our culture and its understanding of what it means to be human, and of course, what it means to be an animal. Shifting to the issue of the filibuster in the United States Senate, you'll recall that in recent days, a majority of Democratic senators voted to change the rules of the Senate. Eliminating the filibuster when it comes to presidential nominations, the filibuster, of course, had protected the rights of the minority party, whether at the various moment that minority party was the Democratic Party or the Republican Party. And why did the Democrats do that? Well, as was also acknowledged by the White House, President Obama has been trying to direct the federal courts to the left, understanding that the role of these courts is so important in our society that if he has a lasting impact from his presidency, it's going to have to be extended into the courts. And the president is following a kind of example that was set, for instance, by Franklin Delano Roosevelt when he attempted to pack the U.S. Supreme Court. This president is trying to add new judges to appellate courts in order to weight them towards the more liberal direction. Republicans have been opposing that. That was why the Democrats took the extreme action of voting against over 200 years of precedent in the Senate to eliminate the filibuster for presidential nominations. But the New York Times has a very interesting article that came out on Saturday explaining why the Democrats did this, because they've threatened to do it in the past. For that matter, the Republicans have threatened to do it when they were in the majority, but the Republicans didn't do it, and until now, the Democrats didn't do it. But just a few days ago, the Democrats did do it, with all but three joining Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid in overthrowing the precedent and tradition of the Senate. Why? Well, the New York Times explains the issue was abortion. Jeremy Peter reports that it was actions in the federal courts, at the district court level and the appellate courts, that had allowed the states to add increased restrictions to abortion that led the majority of Democrats in the Senate to say they were going to break with tradition and eliminate the filibuster in order to get President Obama's nominees added to the courts. As he says, Democrats believed that they had allowed this delay to cause them to fall back in such a way that these courts were ruling to affirm actions taken by states such as Texas to curtail abortion rights. As he also says, this led abortion rights defenders in the Senate, such as Senator Barbara Boxer, the Democrat of California, an ardent defender of abortion rights, to decide to put aside her misgivings in eliminating the filibuster and to go ahead with it. In large part, he says, because the recent court action was so alarming to her. What this article tells us very clearly, citing the Democratic senators themselves, is that the issue of abortion was at the forefront of their action, and abortion was at the forefront of their desperation. And this tells us something else. The defenders of abortion feel themselves now to be on the defensive, and that is really interesting. Now, so many years after Roe v. Wade, 40 years ago, American pro-abortion senators are acting in desperation to defend abortion rights. That tells us something about how they're losing the argument on one hand across the nation, especially in states such as Texas and other states, 28 states, as a matter of fact, that have adopted new restrictions on abortion just in the last 24 months. Of course, on the two coasts, the East Coast and the Left Coast, there is still a great deal of support for abortion rights. And when it comes to the issue of abortion, Americans clearly do not have a stable mind. According to polls, a majority of Americans say they believe abortion is the killing of an innocent baby. A majority of Americans say that abortion should be limited to very rare situations. But a majority of Americans, although a very slim majority, say they want Roe v. Wade to stand. In other words, a great deal of moral conflict in the minds of many Americans. And up until now, there had been a divided mind in the Senate, where there had been the constant temptation to eliminate the filibuster, but both parties, when they had been in the majority, had stopped short of actually changing the tradition of the Senate, a tradition that had been understood for over 200 years to protect the rights of the minority. That tradition was cast aside, and now we know the reason why. The reason was abortion, and the desperation was to that issue and that issue alone. As the year 2013 comes to a close, you should expect to see a raft of articles and news analyses suggesting that, as one recent commentator said, 2013 was the gayest year in gay history. It will be seen, by almost any calculation, as a crucial turning point in the moral and sexual revolution taking place around us. National Public Radio's reporter Alan Greenblatt pointed to the year 2013 as the greatest year in gay rights history, already, and the year's not over. I say the year's not over because more can still happen. As he reports, any day now, the New Mexico Supreme Court may grant same-sex couples the right to be married in that state. But he's looking at what has already taken place in the year 2013 on the issue of gay rights. He cites Eric Marcus, the author of the book Making Gay History, who said, quote, "This year represented the true tipping point. We've reached a moment in history where it's very difficult, if not impossible, to go back." It was Fred Sains, vice president of the gay rights group Human Rights Campaign, who called 2013 the gayest year in gay history. Greenblatt summarizes that in the year 2013, gay rights advocates almost can't believe the progress they've already made. Kate Kendall, executive director of the National Center for Lesbian Rights, said, quote, "To describe the events of the year as breathtaking is woefully inadequate," end quote. Did we see this coming at the beginning of the year? Well, in one sense we did. We knew that the United States Supreme Court was going to take up two very crucial gay rights cases, indeed same-sex marriage cases. And in both of those cases, you found the Supreme Court siding, to some extent, with the advocates of same-sex marriage and its legalization. And now you have people such as Mark Harris, a film critic and cultural historian, saying, quote, "With every state that has passed marriage equality, it becomes a little less of a headline and a little more an advance of a norm. Everyone feels it's only going in one direction," end quote. Well, just consider the fact that several states just this year have acted to legalize same-sex marriage. And, of course, the United States Supreme Court in the Windsor decision struck down the Defense of Marriage Act and thus eliminated the fact that the United States government had only recognized marriage as the union of a man and a woman. You know, when you read these reports, it's hard to argue with the fact that 2013 just might be the gayest year in gay history. One of the other very interesting aspects of the analysis coming from National Public Radio's Alan Greenblatt is the fact that there is one individual who more than any other stands at the center of this story, and that person is President Barack Obama. It was President Obama who, when he was running for re-election in 2012, changed his position in order to become an advocate of legal same-sex marriage. It was President Obama who, in January of this year, in his second inaugural address, stated that it was time for all Americans to recognize the rights of same-sex couples to marry. And Jonathan Rauch, a resident scholar at the Brookings Institution, says that when it comes to gay civil rights, in his words, Obama has been the gay's Lyndon Baines Johnson, the gay's LBJ. Recognizing the fact that it was under LBJ that the Civil Rights Act was passed in 1964, thus a crucial turning point in that moral revolution, now Rauch says President Obama is the LBJ for gay rights. Speaking of President Obama's influence, Jonathan Rauch is very clear. He said, quote, "Before Obama, it was possible to say that gay rights was a controversial but fringy concern." He then stated, "After Obama, it is agree or disagree, but gay rights is 100% mainstream," end quote. Well, as I said, stay tuned because we're going to see a flood of stories like this. And the reason why is quite simple. They're making a point that deserves to be made. 2013 is, in all likelihood, going to be seen as the key critical turning year in this issue of the sexual revolution. Turning from NPR to the BBC is out with a major report that was released just yesterday. Its health reporter releases the news that men and women's brains are, to use the sophisticated language of the BBC, quote, wired differently, end quote. This is one of those stories that tells you something we already knew. But it's really interesting that all of a sudden the BBC and a United States team at the University of Pennsylvania have announced that it's news because they scanned the brains of nearly 1,000 men, women, boys, and girls, and they found, get this, striking differences. As they explain, male brains appear to be wired front to back, with few connections bridging the two hemispheres. In females, the pathways crisscross between left and right. These differences may explain, said these researchers, why men in general tend to be better at learning and performing a single task, like cycling or navigating, whereas women are more equipped for multitasking. You might also say, in other words, motherhood. Oh, and by the way, the researchers are onto something else you already knew, but evidently they didn't. This explains why men and women, now get this, need each other. Because, as it turns out, you put two people who have the front-to-back wiring together, you lack the kind of hemispheric connectivity you get if you put a man and a woman together. As study author Dr. Ruben Gurr said, quote, it's quite striking how complementary the brains of men and women really are, end quote. Now, there's that word, complementary. Where have we heard that before? Well, let's recall that that is one of the most historic Christian ways of explaining theologically what is revealed in the book of Genesis, that God said of man, it is not good for Adam to be alone. He would make a helper, a complement, fit for him. In other words, complementarianism goes right back to the book of Genesis, right back to the declaration of the Creator, and right back to what we knew before we knew that researchers at the University of Pennsylvania found out that men and women have their minds wired differently. File that once again under things you knew before they told you so. Thanks for listening to The Briefing. For more information, go to my website at albertmoeller.com. You can follow me on Twitter by going to twitter.com/albertmoeller. For information on the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, go to sbts.edu. For information on Boyce College, just go to boycecollege.com. However your mind is wired, I'll meet you tomorrow for The Briefing.